First Peter chapter 2, we worked on this some Sundays. We've got into this section here that's talking a lot about submission, you know, in different ways, different aspects, different relationships in life. It's kind of interesting that Peter would roll into this point here of submission at this time, where he's been talking about just our relationship in Christ, in our relationship to God. And I guess in some ways should not be a surprise that submission becomes a part of this in our daily lives. Of course, there has to be submission to Christ and to God. But on Sunday, what we talked about some was submission to government. We talked about a lot of different aspects of that, how that can be very hard, because sometimes government's not so easy to be submissive to. But still, there has to be this way about us, this attitude of being willing to submit to rule, because, in fact, governments were put in place by God. And he had his place and his purpose for that, even as this text would say, you know, for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. So God has sanctioned that. We got into some discussion, the passage here of submission to masters in chapter 2, beginning of verse 18. We're taking back up in our study there tonight. In fact, we'll take a moment here just to read through that text again. And we talked about halfway through that. And I think some really important points that's going to come out of that tonight. But let's go to the text, 1 Peter chapter 2, and beginning at verse 18, where he says, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable if, because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer for it, you take it patiently. This is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but have now turned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls." Okay, so working back into some thoughts and discussion here on submission, subjection to masters. We made the points. We talked about already the fact that, boy, it's not so hard to be submissive to a master who is kind and gentle and cares something about our well-being. What the text also says, though, is that we have responsibility to be submissive to even to those who are harsh. This is commendable, you know, is what the apostle says. If because of conscience toward God one endures grief, suffering wrongfully, it's commendable to God. Sometimes suffering is going to take place because sometimes there are masters that will be harsh and will be just make some things very difficult. Why be submissive, especially of having to endure abuse? We kind of left off on this point on Sunday, you know, looking at verses 19 and 20. I want you to answer this for me. You know, why be submissive, especially if you're having to endure abuse? And how do we deal with that? Why?
Love your neighbors and hate your enemies. But I say, if you love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and do those who hate you, and pray for those who despise you. Christ.
Right.
Till death.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
abuse of mankind.
Yeah.
And so we're to take that example and apply it.
Well.
And divine judgments as we go through.
And if we do that, I mean, if we demonstrate the right attitude and we are submissive when we should be submissive, I mean, who really should be lifted up because of that? It's not about us, is it? It honors God. I mean, God should be glorified in that. I think we see that a little bit more as the text goes on. Here's kind of where we're taking up again with some new material. You know, at verse 21 again, when he says, "For to this you were called." Well, to this you were called. To what were you called? What's he talking about? What's the subject he's talking about? Suffering. I mean, from chapter 1, verse 6, he's talked about suffering. It's kind of come in and out of the discussion as we've come through persecution, trial, suffering. "For to this you were called." Well, you got to stop there for just a second and think about that. Okay, so to be a Christian, we're called to suffering? Well, sometimes, yes. And that's what he was saying here. Now, it's a little bit hard for me to get a hold of that. You know, to stop and just and think about that for a second, that we were called to suffering. In certain aspects, yes.
Well, you don't know the impact you may have on them either.
That's true, too.
They could, not saying it'll happen every time, but they could eventually see that you don't revile others or them that way, you may be meant for Christ.
Well, what about those at Pentecost? Likely some who were there at the crucifixion of Christ. Okay? Christ was the one who was suffering. Christ was the one who was submissive. And yet here, the 50 days later, there were some who were pricked in their heart and said, "Men and brethren, what should we do?" Who would have thought that? That some of the ones who would have been taking part of the crucifixion of Christ would be the ones who were saying, "What should we do?" Because now they knew and they believed that Christ was the Son of God.
We're called to take up our cross and follow Him. Mm-hmm. So, Jesus suffered on the cross.
Yeah. Yeah, yet in a very literal way, Christ carried that cross. Cross of suffering and pain. Look at this a little bit more. Okay, it's interesting that the rest of this paragraph is addressed to servants who suffer. It is here that Peter draws upon the powerful account of the suffering servant. That's much of what is quoted here in the text. It's from Isaiah 53, when he says, let's go back to verse 21 again. "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth." So let's think about some of these phrases. Make some comments. "For to this you were called." What were we called? We've dealt with this. We were called to suffering here. Christ suffered for us, became that example in that way. We might have to suffer for Christ's sake. I mean, Christ suffered all the way to the cross. Yeah, we might have to endure a master that's not kind to us. That's the suffering. And through that, we still have to demonstrate a Christ-like attitude. The text says, leaving us an example. Of whom is it speaking? Who left an example? An example of what? What do we see?
Of suffering.
Christ left? Yeah. I mean, you can imagine that, you know, those who were receiving the letter were saying, "So we're supposed to suffer? Why would we want to suffer? Did Christ want to suffer?" And he prayed that if the suffering could bypass him, you know, if that would be the will of God. But it wasn't. Here's what had to happen. You know, Christ didn't want to suffer, but he was willing to suffer because of what that would do. You know, he left us an example of humble suffering. Now, the text says we should follow in his steps. Well, in what way should we follow in his steps?
Well, there are a number of European cultures. Within European cultures, there's a tradition of people who will go through the streets in certain seasons. Whips and flog themselves basically as they go through the streets. I think it has to
They didn't have to look for trouble.
They didn't have to look very far, but they were everybody going to lock them.
Yeah.
And of course, Paul, you know, repeatedly,
yeah,
after death, after
right,
stoned and all such as that, but it wasn't because he was looking for it. He was preaching the gospel.
Yeah.
And he was going about doing righteousness, which was what Jesus did, and the envy and unrighteousness of men began to be manifest because they loved darkness rather than light.
Yeah.
So if we're persecuted for loving the light, then that's what's being, we're called to.
That's it.
But we're not called to just go out there and look to be beaten.
We don't even have to look for that. What are the thoughts you have? Comments? Sure.
Things. This is just one aspect of what we're called.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point is, if it comes to that,
mm-hmm,
you have to be willing to suffer. Not that you're looking for it, but if it comes to it, you need to be willing.
Which that phrase fits in there appropriately because the whole text is about suffering. We're called to that. That's not to say that we're not called to do other things. We're called to be righteous. We're called to be godly. We're called to be the people of God. We're called to be a lot of different things. In this text, it fits that we are called to suffer, if that's what we must do. Well, okay, in what ways might we suffer? We haven't suffered much. That's why we don't have ready answers for this, really.
It's all Tarsus went and dragged people out of their houses and arrested them, and in some cases killed them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the extreme.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Absolutely.
Christians have suffered before. We've lived through a period of time in this nation where we haven't had to suffer because of our faith. Don't know it'll always be that way. You know, don't like the way some things look. But who knows, there could come a point in time here in this country where we have to suffer, you know, in incredible ways because of our faith. But in the way we view suffering, in what ways might we suffer? Because we are Christians. Well, thinking more just because we're a Christian. In what ways, if we're a Christian, might we have to suffer?
Loss of friends or family relationships.
That's happened to a lot of us. You know, we're estranged from some because of our faith. And because of the life that we are going to be determined to live, it's going to separate us from some. That'll happen, sure. Yeah, and in the job, sometimes, there's supposed to not be religious discrimination. Sometimes there is. And sometimes there's things that affect our job because...
We didn't understand that statement.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to have religious discrimination against anybody but Christians.
Yeah, that may be right, yeah. Sometimes there can be some situations in the workplace or in community or school that become difficult. Sure. Suffering, to some degree. Other things. We've been very blessed when we have to struggle. You know, in the first century, and I mean, think of those that Peter was writing to. Did they know something about suffering? Already they did. There was greater suffering that was coming. I mean, already Nero was breathing down the necks of Christians that were close to him. I mean, it hadn't really spread real far at this point. But into a period of time, and it was going to become even more so, that it was not a good time to be a Christian. I mean, it's like, you know, in the days of Domitian, well, really in the days of Nero, I guess, too, in Rome, Christians burning on stakes at night to light the streets? I mean, that's hard to fathom, isn't it? I mean, we can't even get a grasp of that. Suffering. But you were called. To this you were called. Now see, these Christians knew something more about suffering. Maybe they hadn't suffered yet. Well, no, he said they had. They already endured difficulties. They knew something about, suffering. But in his second letter, when he writes to them, it appears they've become even more acquainted with the suffering that they would have to endure. We don't understand that.
Jerusalem. When you see these things happen,
yeah,
when you see it in Jerusalem encompassed by armies, and you know this and that, get out of there,
yeah.
Flee this. So again, Jesus wasn't just throwing them into the lions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That wasn't the point.
Yeah.
Yes, there were people that were terribly persecuted and still are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Muslims would like to have all of us beheaded.
Sure, sure.
Any Christians anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's their goal.
Yeah.
And it's happening in some places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to be a Christian in some places in the world.
Sure.
It's easy here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Jesus, again, he wasn't unconcerned even in that time.
Mm-hmm.
For the people who were going to be suffering. But he did predict it. He said, yes, you're going because I did, you will.
And became that example for us, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes we are healed. It says of him, he says, he committed himself to him who judges righteously. You know, what is Peter's point to us with regard to our call to submission? What would you think or say? I mean, to whom was Jesus committed to in the text? He was committed to him who judges righteously, to God. And we have to have that same commitment. In verse 25, there in the chapter, an interesting statement here. He says, for you were like sheep going astray, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. What's he talking about? What's the idea of that? That text. Of whom is he speaking?
Well, we've got to debate about whether he's addressing Jewish Christians or Gentile Christians, and there seems to be some indication in previous passages that he's talking, at least in part, to Gentile Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And spiritually, they were like sheep gone mm-hmm. away from God, and they've been called back.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Jesus, I would think, of this shepherd and overseer of your souls. And again, the focus being here, what Jesus can do for our souls. It, you know, when Jesus is being identified as the one who is protecting them from physical harm, that was not the point of discussion. Physically, they may suffer. There may be suffering that takes place. But in the bigger part of the picture here, he's overseeing and blessing their souls. That's the point of greater importance there. Look on top of page 9. Everybody got page 9? There's copies back here in the back. I think everybody should already have page 9. Storyline continues. Goes into a new chapter, but same storyline here. So talking about submission. I mean, there's three different aspects, or maybe relationships, we would say, you know, with regard to submission to government, submission to masters. Now we can talk about relationships of husband and wives here. Chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Do not let your beauty be that outward adorning of arranging the hair, of wearing gold, or of putting on fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are as long as you do good and are not afraid with any terror. All right. See what discussion we find here. I mean, the situation that kind of hits us forefront here in the first two verses is maybe that of a married woman who is married to a man who is not a Christian. We've seen already that what the apostle is trying to help us see is that we might have some impact for good among those who are not Christians or those who are unkind to us by demonstrating a Christ-like disposition. Same theme here, same thought, you know, kind of continuing in this. You know, Christian wives can have an influence for good, you know, even if their husbands are not Christians, by presenting a pure heart and a submissive attitude. So let's look at some of the questions we have here. Discuss the difficulty of being a Christian and being the spouse of someone who is not. Well, some of us can only address that by observation, you know, and I mean, what are some of the difficulties? You name off some things that's difficulties in a relationship because of that. What are some problems?
Sometimes.
I've seen both sides of that. Sometimes a husband who makes it very difficult for a wife to serve the Lord faithfully. I've seen the side where husband doesn't care. You can do whatever you want to do. Just don't tell me if I don't want anything to do with it. You know, I've seen both extremes of that even. There can be some real difficulties with raising the children. You know, and trying to teach children, you know, the Bible, types of entertainment that it might be allowed in the house, being able to entertain, you know, inviting your Christian friends to the house might be something that's not allowed. There can be a lot of problems, you know, in a home where the wife is a Christian, the husband is not. But I mean, it was something that was being dealt with in the first century. It's not a new problem or issue to Christians now. I mean, Peter's writing about this for some reason, some purpose. So how did Peter advise that believing wives approach this issue with their husbands? What can they do? What's the text say? Yeah, it can't change your relationship with the Lord. As the text would say, you know, to be submissive to your own husbands. Well, that's hard. Well, sure. It's hard being submissive to a government that's not godly. It's hard being submissive to a master who is ungodly or who maybe is harsh. It can be very difficult for a wife to be submissive to a husband that's not a Christian. But still, what the apostle is saying is that here, you still have to demonstrate this submissive role. Your comments, your thoughts. Well, same situation, right? In the same situation.
You don't always know from my own experience. I don't always know until Sunday morning which children are coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it does inhibit me from getting here a lot of times for class. If I am here, I'll be late. I'm still here. It makes it very difficult. And you just do the best you can. And, you know, in that situation, the only thing that you can do is what he's saying here. It's
what Peter tries to suggest here, what he's telling us, is that here's where you can have some influence, where you might be able to win your husband to the Lord by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Back to the submissive attitude again. And, you know, trying to have this chaste conduct. Well, what does that mean? Look in verse 2 where it says, you know, to demonstrate this chaste conduct. What is that? Mm-hmm. Certainly going to get into to the aspect of dress and adorning the inward woman as opposed to outward. But when you break down these words right here, chaste conduct, you know, you kind of look at what words are being used there. The idea of chaste is the idea of purity. And it's kind of used in a broad way here that, you know, purity in every aspect of behavior. You know, modeling godliness, you know, so to speak, is the idea here. You know, consistent, steady, and steadfast. I have seen some cases, perhaps you have too, where there's a woman who's faithful to the Lord, Christian, serving the Lord in every aspect of her life that you can see. Her husband is not. But sometimes in years later, the effect of that attitude and godliness has an effect. Now, I've seen a lot of times where it has not changed a man at all. But I've seen the case. I've baptized some men who've been married for 30, one time a man married over 50 years, you know, to a godly woman who in time, finally, some of that rubbed off. So yeah, that does happen.
The scriptures says, I mean, this is a hopefulness that's
yeah.
provided by God.
Yeah.
There's a formula to follow. I know what I'm saying.
Yeah, there is still kind of a surprise to it, you know, when it has happened. Because there's been so many times where it's not, you know. But it can happen. Sometimes there'll be a young lady maybe who's looking at getting married to someone who's not a Christian. It's just something that I've just never been able to encourage at all. And sometimes they'll say, well, look, maybe I might have this effect, you know, where maybe, you know, in time, you know, he'll become a Christian. Well, yes, maybe that's a possibility. But more times than not, I've not seen that happen. And what I've seen happen too many times is he has had a stronger effect on her than she has had on him. So that's kind of a scary situation.
But it does work. I'm an example of that. There's a number of other men here.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that it has to do with the general heart of the person that you're dealing with.
Sure. No doubt.
In my case, Gina and I had discussions about our beliefs and understanding of where those truths took us. And before we got married, I assured her that I was very much interested in truth. I was brought up as a on again Methodist. But I learned the truth. And she married me before I was obeying the gospel. But I was very it's true. And so I think, you know, the dividing point, I guess, as to what, it's not always a bad thing, I guess, in my case it wasn't, to marry someone who, it's a good thing to marry someone who is a Christian, if you're interested in what's true.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm speaking from experience.
Mm-hmm. Good thoughts. What else?
In Les's case, it worked out well. A lot of times, a guy will tell the woman he's interested in marrying, who's spiritual, I'll study with you, and I'll do this, and I'll do that. And they're just saying those things mm-hmm. so they can get married to the person. And then once they're married to the person, they've got them,
mm-hmm.
they never show any more interest.
Yeah.
So it really gets back to the heart.
It does.
He had
it does.
Heart. He was
always. Good thoughts.
You just never know when something you say or do in a situation like that will trigger something that might change in my life. As a youngster, my mother was a strong one, and she made sure the kids went to church and Sunday school every week. And my dad was a good Lutheran, and so he only had to go on Christmas and Easter. And so one day, as we were going marching out to church, and my dad is sitting there in his big oversized chair reading the funny papers, and so I asked my mother in front of him, when am I going to get old enough so that I can stay home and read the funny papers?
Mm-hmm.
He heard it, took it to heart.
Hmm. Is that right? That's amazing. That's good stories. Good stories. Look at verse 3. But do not let your beauty be that outward adorning of arranging the hair, of wearing gold, or of putting on fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. The beauty that God is looking for. Look at the passage here. Let's make some comparisons here. What's he looking for? Narrow it down. Doug?
Heart.
The heart. The hidden person of the heart. This is an appearance that's pleasing to God. You know, what our heart would lead us to do. I mean, the overall context is talking about godliness, is talking about submission. That hasn't changed. That's still what's being talked about. You know, right here, an appearance that's pleasing to God. In the text, there are two kinds of beauty described. What are the two kinds of beauty described in the text? Inward and outward. I mean, I have said at times our society is just eat up with outward appearance. And, you know, I don't know that it's ever been any different, really. You know, I mean, every society has had its times where if there's any affluence at all, any ability to promote outward appearance, that's always been done. I mean, in biblical times, we see that. So that's not really anything that's any different. We live in an affluent country, and for some, that allows greater opportunities to just kind of, you know, to show outward appearance. And so we see a lot of that in our time and in our society. I mean, if you look at, you know, when you look at the media, when you look at you know, TV and TV programs, Facebook, you look at what kids put on Facebook, you know, sometime, as far as about what is in, what's cool, what are they doing, what are they wearing. It's all stuff about outward appearance. I mean, that just so much is the focus. And it's hard to find people, whether young people or older people, that's just really focused on trying to refine the heart, refine inward appearance. And that's what this is all about. I mean, I think Jennifer made a good point here. It's not saying that you can't comb your hair and you can't fix up some. But the contrast that's being made is that all one looks at is the outward adorning of the arranging the hair and wearing gold and putting on fine apparel. I mean, if that's all that is seen, well, then we've missed the real person. Well, let me back up. Sometimes that is the real person because that's the heart coming out. You know, that's what we see. Exactly.
One thing that my dad's brought up for a couple lessons is this passage is an example of a idiom in Greek where they use a not but phrase. And it's what's called an ellipsis where they leave an important word out, but the reader or listener knows what the word should be, at least in the Greek that's how it was, and it's not often translated that way. That there's the important phrases or words is that it should be read not only but also, but that's left out to bring your attention to what was left out. And it also in the way the idiom works is it stresses that what comes after the but is far more important than what comes before.
And what the emphasis becomes then is that hidden person, the heart. You know, the hidden person of the heart with an incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more time as we go on. You know, this idea of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Seems like there should be some emphasis kind of placed on that. Maybe we can spend a little bit of time on that on the Lord's Day, Sunday morning.